Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Investors Chronicle interview podcast. I'm Dan Jones. I'm pleased to say today we're joined by Katie Potts, manager of the Herald Investment Trust. Katie established Herald Investment Management 30 years ago in 1993 and has managed the tech-focused trusts since its launch in February 1994. She began her career at Barings Investment Management and prior to founding Herald was a top-rated city analyst of electronics companies in the 80s and 90s. Katie, welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So we'll begin with the straightforward one, or maybe not so straightforward, we'll see. You've obviously been investing in the sector for several decades now, a long time. How do you value technology stocks? What metrics are most important to you looking at companies and how, if at all, has that changed over the years?
Clearly, technology is a growth sector and we focus on growth companies. It's more complicated trying to work out what the future profits might be. And we've, because of the smaller company focus of the trust, we focus on companies at time of investment, at any rate, on market capitalizations below 3 billion. But our median market cap is a lot lower than that. In fact, it was 167 million at the end of June. And we are, there's a life cycle to how we invest. We tend to invest when the companies are small and let our bigger successful companies run. So the top 20 holdings we've got, we've owned for 12 to 13 years. But at the early stage, we often buy when it's loss-making. And you say, how do you value a company when it's loss-making? And I think we have to look at what are the gross margins of the business? What's the growth rate? How much do they have to grow the cost base to grow the revenues? But I think at the back of my mind is a valuation sense check. Even if it's loss-making, you've got to think, what has this company got to do to be on a P of 10? How much have the revenues got to grow? And how many years will it take to get the market cap back in profits? And clearly there are a lot of variables, and so it can't be a precise measure, but it's why software companies which have 100%, nearly 100% gross margins on a marginal sale, you can expect there to be a kicker to the bottom line more than a manufacturing company where they have got to buy components and products and use machines and the gross margin is a lot lower. But historically, we've always run with about 17% of the portfolio in early stage loss-making companies, and then we own them going forwards. In fact, we've only got 12% in loss-making companies at the moment, and that's because we were aware there was a bit of a bubble a couple of years ago, not so much in the stock market, but there was a bit of a bubble in venture capital and PE and a degree of fashion for the sector in public markets, and took the view that with interest rates rising, money becoming more expensive, you know, the P of cash is more like 20 times now, as it was over 100 times not very long ago. So that's understandable reason why valuation should be lower, because the risk-free return is that there is at least a return, even if it's not a return in real terms. And we're expecting there to be a lot of people who are having to raise money. And that is when you move into a buyer's market territory, which we're beginning to see already. I think we've been approached by 70 companies this year for fundraisings of primary capital. And that's when there are interesting valuations. I struggle with some US valuations because you sometimes or quite often see companies with a billion of retained losses. And you think, heck, you know, when are they going to get a billion back in profits? And there's some of the valuations there. There's a degree to which you can't see the market cap coming back in profits on a reasonable time frame. And as far as I'm concerned, that you're then investing on the greater fool theory, that somebody will pay even more for it than you will. And there's an element where you have to play the market and realize what's fashionable and that somebody's going to get excited by this. And it's a common mistake people make in investing, particularly with IPOs, is people dress it up to say there's 40% growth and tempt you to think that it's 40% growth ad infinitum. And often they're clever at dressing it up so that they put lots of sales marketing in just before an IPO and get the growth. But actually, they're penetrating the market quicker than you might think. So that's another factor. You think, well, how big is the potential market? How long can they go on growing at 40%? And there are times when it's easy to measure, like say accounting software. It's easy to know every firm needs accounting software. You know how big the market is. You know how many SMEs there are. You know how many mid-cap companies there are. You know how many large companies. It's more complicated with a market like AI. It's very
when the target market is impossible to discern, perhaps.
Exactly. But I think the evidence, I'm sure some people have already played with ChatGPT. You can see how powerful it is. But at the end of the day, to make a market, you really need a market that people will pay for. How big will that be? And going back to the US-UK, the US has been fantastic at giving lots of capital to companies, but almost too much, which means that you struggle to get the metrics that I like to work. On the other hand, there's greater support for tech companies in America than there is in the UK because they've had a handful of successes that have done really well. You know, the famous FANGs have done so well. Everyone's looking for the next one. And you've got to think, well, actually, can this company really grow like that? Because is the addressable market that big? In the UK, it's much lower risk because people are nothing like as optimistic. On the other hand, equally, people aren't given the money to grow and become market leaders in the same way.
So on the subject of US v UK, then, you know, this has obviously been a big focus this year, not just in tech, but in you know, investment markets, equity markets in general. Mm-hmm. It sounds like, you know, there are, from your point of view, there are pluses and minuses to both sides of the equation. Do you think in the UK there are structural reasons other than, you know, simply the amount of money people are prepared to give to tech stocks? Are there structural reasons for the amount of money people are prepared to give relative to the US?
I mean, the real problem in the UK is, I think people are increasingly aware, but we've been rabbiting on about it for a long time. Partly because when I raised the fund, I raised $65 million in 1994 and $30 million 2 years later and haven't raised any money since. We bought back over £300 million worth of stock and the assets are over $1.2 billion now. So I think it's 22 times return since inception. But then I raised the money from insurance companies and pension funds. And I watched the register morph over time as the pension funds and insurance companies sold out because they have the defined benefit. Companies have left the pension market. And our share register has been replaced more by wealth managers, and there's still a small number of pension funds left. But that has been reflected in the registers of the companies we invest in the UK as well. And that pension funds have withdrawn, insurance companies have withdrawn. And particularly at the smaller end, it's rather left funds and individuals being the investors. So there has been a shortage of capital. And it does mean that valuations have been higher in the States. So they have seen UK assets as cheap and bought them. And I've actually done the exercise of seeing how many takeovers we've had in the UK. Since 20, including 2015 to current, we've had 57 takeovers, and that's just in small cap tech. So it's quite a lot of companies, and that's been 273 million in value of takeovers. I think one of the second problems that's emerged, I think exaggerated by MiFID, is there's been a bifurcation between small cap brokers and large cap brokers. in days gone by, the big houses did have a small cap team and did float companies. But now there is an inefficiency that as the small companies grow, their shareholder base doesn't naturally move to large cap shareholders because they don't deal with the small cap brokers. So companies can get stuck and be an attractive value to either a PE house or a US owner.
Do you think the situation will improve on a number of fronts? I suppose, firstly, in terms of the efforts being made to try and change this this landscape of investment. Secondly, in terms of the valuation gap between the UK and the US, as you say, that can sometimes close via takeovers. But in both those things, are you optimistic both for a change in the landscape and also the prospect of stocks rising?
Well, one good thing is, whereas I've gone on about the issue for a decade or more, I think there's now a much wider realization there's an issue. And once people recognize there is a problem, that's a significant part of the way towards addressing it. But there is, of course, the problem that because we're borrowing so much money as a country, there's competition for people to buy gilts in the UK, treasuries in the US, euro bonds in Europe, but everywhere governments have got big fiscal deficits, and where's the money coming from? So that is the cloud over the market, not over tech, but over the whole market. There is competition for capital now with bonds to a greater extent than ever. But another reason why it should improve is that we're lucky enough to meet management teams with our smaller company global focus. Although we have 40% in the UK, we do have 25% in the States and smaller slugs in Asia and America. And what I'm acutely aware of, and have been frustrated for the last 9 months, I think, when the Bank of England were being so negative about the UK economy, I scratched my head and thought, go around the world, everybody's worried about their headache and everybody thinks their headache's the worst. And I think the British are better at shouting about it.
Right.
I'm not in the least surprised. I think the GDP figures in the UK have been slightly better than expected. And that's what it feels like at the bottom. It doesn't feel like a recession when you're talking to companies. There's been a bit of softness in advertising. And I think the consumer is affected by rising interest rates and inflation. But on the whole, UK feels pretty stable compared to other countries. And I think partly because we've been so public about addressing the problems we've undoubtedly got in terms of fiscal deficits and interest rate rises and so on. But I think because we've been so public about it, people have been net sellers of UK equities. And there have been record outflows almost every month of UK equities from funds. And if there are more sellers than buyers, it means share prices go down. And that has been reflected in our first half performance, where overall we were sort of all but flat in NAV per share. But within that, we lost money quite significantly in the UK. The UK returned minus 11.5%. And in contrast, our US portfolio was up 21%. But that's sort of easy to spot. What is hidden behind that is if you look at the average PE of those stocks, the average PE in the UK has declined 8%. So that's just a simple way of saying UK stocks are cheaper than they were at the start of the year. And interestingly, we've done the analysis on our own portfolio, and at the end of 2020, the PE of the UK was 26 times, and it's now 15 times. So I'm glad to say that our return hasn't shrunk nearly as much as the PE has. So things are looking a lot cheaper than they were. But it is in stark contrast to the overseas markets, where every overseas market is more expensive than it was at the start of the year. In particular, our North American portfolios, the PE has gone up by 33.8%. So that's a staggering difference, that the UK is derated while the US has got more expensive. And equally, Asia's 23% more expensive and Europe's 9% more expensive. But I think a lot of it's the psychology of the British being aware of our problems and being negative about it.
Yes, I think that's fair.
And it's the UK investor that's been the seller of, and in the small cap world, overseas investors are largely irrelevant.
So from your perspective then, are you now topping up more on the UK? Are you trying to fight this momentum? Do you think this momentum might shift?
Interestingly, I've done a cash flow exercise, and since 2017, we have taken money out of the UK in every 6-month period until the first half of this year. Overall, we've taken 210 million out of the UK from the 1st of January 2017. And that's partly because of takeovers and partly because I was sort of nervous about the illiquidity of the market and the cash flows. It doesn't actually mean that UK companies have underperformed at a trading level, because in the tech world, it's a global sector and they've got the same markets everywhere. If anything, UK companies have benefited from sterling's been weak over that period of time. And so their overseas earnings have enhanced in sterling terms. And it affects a trading company more than just a share price. When sterling weakens, it's instant gratification for overseas holdings. But it's often delayed gratification for UK holdings because it takes time for profits to come through at a higher level. Does it surprise you that I say everybody thinks their own headache's the worst?
No, that seems like a very natural response. And I think there is a certain Britishness to it as well. You're right. You know, we have had a number of things go wrong, but isn't there maybe the national character to emphasize those?
We all get depressed about politics and worry about UK politicians. And then you look at America and think, well, you know, they're even more stressed about their politicians.
There is a grass is always greener feeling, isn't there?
Yes.
Just to stay on the UK for a moment, and the takeover side that you mentioned. Now, that's been a big theme of the markets. That said, you know, interest rates have risen. Times are a bit tougher for PE. You mentioned companies, you know, looking for cash now. Do you think that rate of takeovers we've seen in the past couple of years will continue? Or do you think that the rising rates have made it harder?
Interestingly, it's the first 6 months period when we've had no takeovers in the UK at all. But it's a topical question today, is that Emmis, the software business, was bid for last year and then referred to Monopolies Commission.
Yes.
And they've announced today that that's okay. But one of the really interesting things about that is the takeover has been there. The buyer hasn't gone away. And just because the mergers authority have said it's okay, the share price is up 25% today. And that shows the gap between the market value and a takeover value, because it must have been still partly considered the takeover would go through. And that's something that's really at odds with the States. Is we've had lots of US takeovers, but often the premium's 10%, or in fact this week, Avid, that does software for the media sector, audiovisual, the takeover there has been announced at a slightly lower price than it reached not very long ago. And often the takeover premium is quite modest in comparison. So it tells you that the American market is valuing things much closer to a takeover value, whereas UK, the takeovers, it's the competitive tension between one acquiring company and another that sets the price, and the public markets tend to be much, much lower. But it's one of the challenges of the UK small cap sector, is that when there are more sellers than buyers because money is leaving the market, if you want to sell stock, you know, you can have to take a discount to realize it in an unwilling market. But then the takeover comes out with a 50 to 100% premium. So a disproportionate part of the return has often come on takeover. I don't think takeovers are wholly negative, because often when new markets, technology opens up new markets, and you often have lots of small players in a new market, and gradually there's consolidation as the winner takes over, and the people who aren't quite winners need to get consolidated. The disappointing thing about the UK market is there hasn't been the funding for people to become the consolidators. The UK companies have always been consolidated. And it's interesting, I don't know, I'm sad that the UK semiconductor sector has, in the public markets, has disappeared. And we've had some strong companies there in the life of Herald. Arm is obviously the most famous one, but there's been Imagination, there's been Wolfson, there's been CSR. And Wolfson was bought by an American company called Cirrus Logic. And by all accounts, the Wolfson contribution is still really important, but it's now a US-listed company. And Arm is clearly going to be a US-listed company again, but sadly, there isn't a semiconductor analyst sector left in London, so it's not really rational to float in London. But it's sad when, if you think how important both Arm and Imagination and Wolfson were to the development of the iPhone, with Arm providing the brains, the processor, Imagination provided the graphics for the screen, Wolfson provided the audio, CSR provided the Bluetooth. A lot of the brains of the iPhone came out of the UK, but the sector isn't left. And it makes me sad that the UK capital markets, you know, valued things lower. So there's a positive and negative to that. The positive is you can buy things more cheaply in the UK. I guess the negative is more as a taxpayer. It upsets me that we let the profits go elsewhere.
Are you, when you add to the UK, as you say, are you finding, in your view, are there enough companies to look at? You know, notwithstanding what you've just said about certain sectors withering away, do you still find, you know, a wide enough range of opportunities?
The UK is entrepreneurial. Mm. There are creative people and there are clever people. I think there are a shortage of co-investors more than there are a shortage of companies. And companies have the temptation that private equity and venture capital will fund them. And there's been a bit of a boom in that area. I'm a passionate sort of believer in the fact that companies should have permanent capital. And ideally, shareholders have perfect liquidity. And the stock exchange is the nearest way of getting that. Private equity is always temporary capital and liquidity from time to time. So it's an imperfect structure. The stock exchanges and natural listed companies is a good natural thing. The irritation is that private equity benefits from the fact they can fund the business with debt and take out profits without paying corporation tax, and they can give management incentives more tax efficiently by giving them shares cheaply in a topco at the time of takeover. But there's no doubt that in the long run, I think things will revert to what's more natural. And I think PE rather than venture capital, that's often where there's been leveraged buyouts. They were clever at exploiting low interest rates and putting far more debt into companies than the public markets would tolerate or be able to do. And it's a big headwind for them that interest rates have now normalized. And it should make public markets more competitive versus private equity. And the other thing is, in a depressed economy, equity is a much better way of funding a business than debt, for obvious reasons. So, you know, if companies funded with debt, interest rates go up, profits go down, and even worse, you can have instability. So it's much better for an economy to have companies funded with equity than debt.
Let's shift gears slightly and turn in part to the US, because the big technology story of the year has been AI and its applications and its potential applications. Clearly, that's been a big boost to mega cap US tech in particular, as well as some of the stocks that you hold, you know, Super Microcomputer being an obvious one there. But I wondered, how much of your portfolio do you deem to be exposed to the theme, and what will be the catalyst for those attributes to be recognized by the market if they haven't been already?
Well, there's two sides of the coin. One is the supply chain to enable AI. And NVIDIA has obviously been the star of the big cap stocks this year because they have the most processing power from their origins as graphic processing company. But they have to go into computers and they have to go into data centers. So there is, we have benefited from some of the supply chain. And Supermicro is one we've had that has made a disproportionate profit for us this year. The US listed company, which makes, as it says, supercomputers, using chips not just from NVIDIA, but also Intel and AMD. But for these high performance computing, a bog standard PC isn't enough. And they build custom computers that go into the data centers. And they have grown very strongly on the back of that demand. But then you can go further down the chain, and another of our companies makes high performance cables with the technology on the end of it to enable faster traffic in data centers. Another company is a switch company because there's demand for faster switching speeds in the data center. So there's a whole supply chain that often are smaller companies that benefit from that upgrade in demand. And then the other side of the coin is which are the applications that are going to benefit from the use of AI. And this is still a bit grey, and I suspect it will be a bit like the internet in 2000. The market grasped the internet was significant, but discounted too many years' growth. And 20 odd years on, I think probably the internet has been more transformational than the greatest optimists of 2000. And I suspect in 20 years' time, we'll look back at AI and realize how very significant it was. In the short term, it's harder to discern who's actually going to make money out of it. But there are two sides to it. Some people are thinking it will enable them to be more efficient in writing software. So there are some software companies that have said that they think that it will reduce their development cost because some recurring chores in the development can be automated. Another dimension which is obviously ripe for improvement is, I'm sure we've all been exasperated by hanging on to utilities, listening to one for this and two for that and three for the other, and they haven't given you the right question. And it's indeed obvious that AI can have a feedback loop to work out what are people's issues and how can we address them. But it's really interesting that a byproduct of that is traditional call centers share prices have been trashed because they think call centers are going to be replaced by AI. And sort of the more interesting dynamic is the better call centers will use AI more efficiently than the weaker ones. But you can see it's more of an iterative process to get there. Obviously, you've got Microsoft and Google producing AI engines, and people are going to pay to use them. So they'll be beneficiaries of the fact they've got a new revenue stream. And I suspect the roadmap for Microsoft is that Office 365, you know, started off with a Word document and a spreadsheet and a PowerPoint, and then we've now seen it increase to incorporate Teams and shared folders on a server. You can just see that the next sort of app built on will be some sort of chat paid for AI tool, and that there will be a raft of things that haven't yet been thought about. It's a bit like, I don't know, if you look at when our houses were first linked up with electricity cables, there was an electric light on the end and maybe an electric fire. But I don't think people conceived that in due course people would have personal computers and microwave ovens and all the other electrical devices we now have. And when the internet started, it was emails and, you know, minimal amount. And now you can see how much that's evolved. And I'm sure there will be some big markets that do emerge. But it will take time where people are applying AI. But I suppose the obvious ones that we will move to having driverless vehicles, but that's not going to happen for a decade, I don't think, because of safety and so on. But think of the economic transformation. If you can have deliveries by robots and we can go on holiday to the north of Scotland.
Yeah.
Overnight, asleep in the car.
Luxury indeed. On the supply chain side of things, I'm curious, you know, clearly NVIDIA, as you say, has been the big winner, but, you know, some of the other aspects of it, you know, the switches, the cables, are these typically US companies still? Is this something where, you know, it seems like this hypothetically could be something where a UK company could be doing something under the radar, as it were? And have those been recognized share price wise?
Bolex is an obvious one that supplies cables to a company called Mellanox, which we used to own, which was taken over by NVIDIA, and they do high-speed things. So there are beneficiaries. It's a small part of their business, but a fast-growing small part of their business.
Well, looking at the UK market in general, then the tech market, you know, we've spoken about, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit in the UK and you know, the good companies that are still out there. But when you look at UK tech, can you draw any, you know, broad generalizations about sometimes the things that they aren't so good at, or the things that make you want to avoid, or if not avoid a company, then at least think, oh, that's kind of a common failing I see among, you know, companies in this space?
I guess one of the key things is people have got to have enough money, and there's a danger with in the UK is that they're very good at innovative products and very bad at realizing that you have to spend three times as much on selling the products as you do on developing it. And that's where the UK has been bad at the follow-on funding to help people commercialize a product, and why so much UK innovation has been marketed more effectively by US capital. The thing, why we've shrunk our loss-making element of the portfolio, is not because we haven't had investment opportunities, but because we're worried about the lack of co-investors. And there are times when we've been the only investor prepared to provide follow-on funding, and we don't want to have too many ships out at sea. And we do by exception go above 10% of companies. We generally like to have a diversified portfolio and keep below 10% because of liquidity, etc. And it's the easiest game in the book to perform in a small cap world if you buy more and more of the same thing. But equally, when a company needs money, prices can get trashed if people have to raise money. And that is, to me, the most exciting opportunity we see over the next year, is where there's a shortage of capital if you've got some money. But you've got to be careful that you don't go for something that needs more capital than our pockets can provide. I say exciting because, you know, they're, when people need money, there's not much competition, and not much competition from other investors to put money in. In a way, a couple of years ago, there was a bit of a bubble.
I was going to sort of say, following on from that, you know, the market has changed slightly. Do you find this a more, maybe a more interesting or maybe a more enjoyable, dare I say, market, even with rates where they are, because we spent a long time in one paradigm and now things are all up in the air again?
Yes, I do tell my younger colleagues when we're down a bit. I think over the two-year period to the end of last year, the average P of the portfolio fell from 30.7 times to 17.8 times. And I said, it's really exciting that we've derated to that degree and the assets have only gone down 10%. And I say you can't expect to have a good time to buy and sell at the same time. And you've got to go through the bad patches to get the good times to buy. And 02, 03 was an absolutely wonderful buying time, because lots of companies had been seeded in the internet bubble of 2000. And a couple of years later, people had fled from the sector, but some people that had been seeded hadn't got enough money to get through. And that provided wonderful buying opportunities. We had a second wonderful buying opportunity in 08-09, when I think the PE went down to 10 then. So an even bigger compression. But again, there'd been a bit of an AIM bubble. There were lots of AIM stocks that came to market in 2005 to 2007. So that provided a wonderful buying opportunity. This time around, the bubble hasn't been in the stock market. The bubble has been in venture. And I think lots of companies have been seeded that will need follow-on funding. I would be surprised if we don't get opportunities. And actually, in the States, the pool of companies between 100 million market cap and 3 billion in our target sectors are about 600 companies. But a third of them came to market in the sort of tech boom of 2021. And we didn't invest in any of those IPOs. We didn't invest in any of the SPACs. It was obviously a speculative period. But it's now a really interesting swimming pool, because I think on average, the IPOs haven't got the most up-to-date figure, but when we did run it, they were down 40%. And some of the SPACs are down 90%. Some of them are uninvestable, but some of them will be interesting. There's been a bit of a spate of IPOs in Japan as well, and that's an area we're more interested in now than we have been. Valuations aren't as stretched as they are in America.
Does all this mean that your turnover rates, with the potential buying opportunities, and also in some cases the need to sell positions, does that mean they're higher than they have been? Do you find yourself more active this year?
No, because the liquidity is so poor. But as I say, it's the first time for years that we've actually put net money into the UK. Not a huge amount, because we're thinking we don't want to spend it too quickly. But equally, I say we've taken a lot of money out of the UK. We've also taken a lot of money out of the US, partly because there have been takeovers, as there have been in the UK, from PE, partly because valuations, we have sold on valuation grounds there, in a way that we've rarely sold stocks in the UK on valuation grounds alone. We've taken 131 million out of North America over a period of time, when we've taken 210 million out of the UK, net invested in Asia, a little bit in Europe. But one of the other dynamics that I'm still trying to work out quite what it means, there's a growing proportion of the market that's index trackers. And it's even bigger in the US than it is here. People have gone for these low-cost trackers. The floor of tracking, whether it's ETFs or indexed funds, is they don't provide primary capital, which should be the basic reason for a market to exist. And it does mean that there are probably more pricing inefficiencies, because so much of the market is now dumb, and a shortage of a reduced skill set of people to work out where to apply primary capital. And I really hope, I think there is a place for index funds, but I really hope it doesn't squeeze active management too much, because that's the important skill set to work out where to allocate money. And I'm really proud of the fact that we've invested over 600 million in primary capital, although we've only raised 95 million of outside capital, and made 22 times on the NAV for our shareholders. An increasing proportion of the market is just not providing primary capital anymore.
No, I think that's a good point. And as you say, we hope that that does continue, or that ability to provide that capital does continue, because it is very important.
But I think there's now political awareness that that's the case. And there's a bit of a disconnect between the regulator who's trying to reduce costs for people and the Treasury who actually wants a growing economy. And it's always the problem. It would be very easy to eliminate car accidents if you reduce the speed limit to naught. The sort of same function that if you eliminate costs of managing money, you might not end up with the outcome you intend.
Indeed. We're running short of time, but maybe just to conclude, sort of wrapping everything up, I feel like, you know, there's an obvious answer to this for any investor and any tech investor, certainly, but you know, putting together all the you know, things we've discussed and looking ahead over the next, you know, 6, 12, 18 months longer, you know, would you describe yourself as optimistic for the portfolio, for investment opportunities, etc.?
Well, there's another important aspect is that I am quite cautious about the world economy because fiscal deficits are too high everywhere, and not just the UK, but in other countries. In fact, we're slightly further down the track of raising taxes and trying to address it. But that has to squeeze the world economy, which is negative for equities, particularly when you've got at least a certain return, even if it's negative in real terms after inflation, from bonds. But it does put a greater premium on companies that actually grow in an environment where the economies are sluggish. And because technology opens up new markets, there's a much greater chance of getting growth. So historically, if you look back, it's periods of sluggish economy where growth companies have outperformed the most. And in that sense, I think there are significant relative attractions to the tech sector. And whatever the economy, there are some companies that are growing, albeit sometimes at other people's expense. But that's where active management should, you know, has the opportunity to pay off.
Indeed. Well, as I say, we have reached the end of time, but thank you so much, Katie, for speaking to us. It's been a great conversation, and I'm sure our listeners will have enjoyed it as well. That brings us to the end of this Investors Chronicle Interviews podcast, but do join us again next time. Thank you and goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.